Over the past year and a half, I have had the privilege to be in community with many, many Jews, and I've learned a lot. I've engaged with thousands of you on social media, in real life in my own city of LA, in Israel, and in many cities across the United States. Today, I want to share with you some of what I've learned. Three revelations I've discovered through speaking with and listening to you. And maybe some of these will seem obvious, but they weren't to me, at least not right away. Number one, Jews wildly overestimate what the world at large knows about Jews. Guys, people don't know anything about Jews. I mean, nothing. The vast majority of people around the world will never meet a Jew in their lives. And that goes for literally millions of Americans. The only touch points the majority of people have with Jews are via three equally destructive avenues. Number one is the news media. And the only time Jews end up in the news is when they can be portrayed as the bad guys or when they're being killed. Not a lot of stories about Jewish wisdom or achievements or celebrations, and certainly no stories about the myriad ways in which they're discriminated against in this country. The second common public touchpoint with Jews is TV and film. As Meta World Peace told me on the show, his first exposure to a Jew was Robert Duvall's lawyer character in The Godfather, which taught him that you go to a Jew when you want to make money. Cool, cool, cool. Of course, he meant no offense by it, and none was taken, but it's a testament to the way in which Jews are so often portrayed on screen, which is one-dimensional, stereotypical, and inauthentic. That is why accurate, contemporary, humanizing Jewish narratives on screen are so important, and any that come close to achieving this aim deserve our full support as a community. The third touchpoint is prejudice, the shit you hear through the grapevine. Jews have horns. Jews only care about money. Jews control the world. Jews control the media. Jews control the banks. Jews control the weather, etc., etc., etc. None of these representations provide an authentic or positive or even factually accurate understanding of who Jews are. And as a result, nobody knows who Jews are. I mean, as Van Jones told me, people don't even know that Greenbaum or Feldstein are Jewish last names. They have no idea. This is a vitally important concept for the Jewish community to grasp as we think about our place in the world and strategize on how to approach others outside the community. My second revelation is that Jews overestimate the size of the anti-Jew, anti-Israel mob trying to topple Western civilization. Most Americans don't want to topple Western civilization. Most Americans don't care about what happens in a Middle Eastern country with which they have absolutely zero connection. Most Americans are not building their entire identities around racist hatred of a single ethnic minority. Remember my first revelation? Most people don't think about Jews at all. Most people either get it and support Jews, or don't have the education or desire to feel any meaningful way about Jews at all, which is its own thing, but not the focus here. Now, of course, this is not to diminish the seriousness or pervasiveness of anti-Jew bigotry, especially at the institutional and cultural level. We absolutely have major problems to address there. But I'm talking about random everyday people, the vast majority of whom are not taking off work to go chant a bunch of crap in Arabic in front of a Jewish person's house. Now, even these people do have certain unconscious biases about Jews, like Jews are fine, which of course is a bigoted assumption rooted in racist lies that all Jews are wealthy and powerful and white, so of course they're fine. But we all have unconscious biases, and they're not a form of active malice. The anti-Jew, anti-Israel community is violent, obnoxious, racist, and completely uninterested in actual peace or dialogue or even reality. And they are loud, but they are small in number. And the same is true of our politicians. If you'll recall, I once discussed a number of cognitive biases on this show, and many of them are at work here. Recency bias, anchoring bias, confirmation bias, perception bias, the availability heuristic, all these little mental shortcuts, which can often be traps, lead us to incorrectly assume that a fringe radical minority is larger and more powerful than it actually is. Don't fall for it. And last, but certainly not least, is a revelation I discovered not just by observing others, but by observing it in myself. For many Jews, and I cannot speak for the Orthodox, though I do know this to be true for conservative, reform, and more assimilated Jews, there is an unconscious and largely unrecognized aversion to allowing yourself to go and feel full Jew. What do I mean by that? I mean, the feeling that you want to go to the Shabbat dinner, you want to be around Jews, you want to connect and have a good time and participate, but you don't want to put your arms around each other and sing Shalom Aleichem or do the long Kiddush or discuss the Parsha of the week or wear a kippah. Not because you've considered each of these traditions and made individual choices about why you dislike them, but because unconsciously there is a voice inside you telling you that to do those things would be too Jewy. Even in our own homes, among our own friends and families, there is a deeply ingrained warning bell that goes off. Whoa, back up, too Jewy. Which, if we're being honest, is another way of saying too uncool or too different or too unassimilated. And that's BS. We didn't put that idea there. We were incepted by Leonardo DiCaprio and a global society that for centuries has been trying to make Jews conform with the Christian or secular majority. So my call to action for this week, go full Jew. Let it rip. Even if it's just for a moment, try it on. Say a blessing before you eat a meal. The whole Western world can't shut up about the importance of being present and expressing gratitude. Judaism has been on that train for thousands of years with all kinds of beautiful blessings and rituals. Don't use the random mantra from the self-help book. Say the motzi. Go full Jew. Make that donation to a Jewish cause instead of listening to the voice telling you it's too self-serving or too insular. No one else has given big money to support us, I'll tell you that. Or on Shabbat, do the long Kiddush. Sing the songs. Take a moment to appreciate the miracle it is for you to be standing here doing the same thing that thousands of other Jews are also doing in Korea, in Chile, in Scotland, in Nebraska. The thousands of Jews have done for thousands of years before you in Tunisia and Latvia and Israel, in temples and attics and caves. Their commitment, their legacy deserves to be honored. And so does the Jew in you, whether anybody else knows a damn thing about it or not. This is the 21st episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. In March of 2020, the world was struck with a devastating and deadly pandemic. COVID-19, coronavirus, the Rona, Coco Roro, took 7 million lives and brought all others to a standstill. Less than a year and a half later, the first vaccines were introduced, allowing life to return to normal. And today, what was once a dangerous killer is now more like a common cold. And amazingly, we have my guest today to thank. A couple times on this show, we've talked about how Jews have won 22% of all Nobel Prizes, despite being only about 0.2% of the world's population. Today, I am thrilled to welcome one of those 22% to the show. He's a globally renowned clinician and researcher, a family man, and works at Penn Medicine, where I was once brought in an ambulance my first week of freshman year after blacking out at the entrance to the quad during new student orientation. Please welcome Dr. Drew Weissman. Dr. Weissman, thank you so much for being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course.
A little over a year ago, you won the Nobel Prize. What was the moment like when you found out you'd won the Nobel? How did that go down?
It was actually a bit funny. I got a text from Katie at 4 a.m. Eastern time.
Katie's your partner?
And, yeah, Katie Carrico, mm-hmm. who I won it with. And it said, "We won." And she said, "You should be getting a call soon." And I didn't get a call. So I spoke with her a few minutes later. And she said they called her. They told her that we had won. And they asked if she had a better phone number for me, because they had tried to call me and couldn't reach me. And the first thing I thought of is, well, this is some, you know, anti-vaxxer playing a joke on us. And thank you for giving them my phone number.
Right.
We waited till 5:30. I got a call. We still didn't fully believe it until 6 when we saw the video of the Nobel presentation. And then we believed it.
What's the process like? Like, do you know you're in the running or it comes out of the blue or how does that work?
We knew we were in the running because, you know, the COVID vaccine was such a big thing. Otherwise, it really comes out of the blue. Other Nobel laureates will put your name in and say, we think you should get it and we'll tell you about it. But it's, you know, you really, there is no, you know, this is the list they're going to choose from.
When you told your parents about you winning, obviously that video went viral. How meaningful was that to you to be able to share this news with your folks?
To me, that was probably the most important thing all morning. The funny part is they left out one sentence from that phone call. My daughter had been married in August before the announcement. And my parents came down and we all went to the wedding. And my daughter was with us when I called my parents. So I when I got my mom on the phone, I said, you know, Rachel's here. We have something to tell you.
Right.
She screamed, Rachel's pregnant. And Rachel, of course, turned red and hid. But luckily, they cut that out.
That's hilarious. I mean, that is, you know, where the grandma's head would be at. It makes sense. Yep. Who had the best reaction to the news?
Probably my younger daughter. We called my older daughter, who hopped on a train from DC and headed up. My younger daughter lives in Philadelphia. We called her. She didn't answer. We kept calling her. She didn't answer. We called her boyfriend. We called her friends. We finally got a hold of her, and she said, what the hell do you want? We told her, she said, fine, I'll see you later, and hung up.
Come on.
Yeah. So she had been out partying late the night before, and I guess wasn't in the mood to be woken up.
I mean, there's certain things you get woken up for, one would think.
Yeah.
I also read that your wife, Mary Ellen, won't let you keep the award in the house. Is that true?
We've gotten a lot of awards, and none of them are in the house.
Where are they?
They're at my work in my office. We're moving to a new house in the summer, and she agreed to let me put the Nobel Prize out.
Mazel tov. That's a good one.
Yeah.
How, if at all, has your life changed since winning? I mean, you said, you know, generally your day-to-day is obviously the same, but like, has it opened new doors? Are people buying you drinks at the bar? Is there any discernible difference?
I think the big thing is that I can now do things that I couldn't do as well. You know, in addition to basic science research, which is my full-time job, I've also spent my career working on equity, working on getting drugs, vaccines, technology to regions that don't have access. So if you look at the COVID vaccines, it took over a year for the RNA vaccines to make it into sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, Latin America. So that's a year after the rest of the world had been vaccinated three times already. Mm. To me, that's always been a big problem.
You also, moving on from the Nobel, won the Harvey Prize from the Israel Institute of Technology, also known as the Technion. What did that award mean to you?
So that was fantastic because it brought me back to Israel. But it was a great recognition from Israel that was one of the earliest countries to take up the vaccine.
Right.
They were the first country to identify the bad status of COVID in pregnant women and started vaccinating pregnant women very early. So that they were leaders in a lot of the vaccine uptake and vaccine studying.
When you received the award, it was June of last year, 2024. What was it like being in Israel at that time, given what has been going on there?
Nerve-wracking. Both Katie Carrico and I were invited, and Katie ended up not going because she was nervous about the situation. you know, the Technion is in Haifa, which is towards the north.
Yeah.
Which at that time, there was a lot of bombing from Hezbollah in the north. So people were nervous about that.
Sure.
We talked to a lot of friends that lived there, and we felt very safe. Most importantly, I made the commitment to go, and I wasn't going to go back on that. So, you know, there could have been fighting in the streets, and I probably still would have gone.
What was the temperature like there? I mean, what was the vibe of the people you were interacting with while you were in the country?
That region, the Haifa region, all of the faiths get along incredibly well. The Jews, the Muslims, the Christians, all of the different faiths really work together, play together, live together very well. There really wasn't the blatant in your face, you're a Jew, go away kind of attitude.
All right, so everyone out there has heard of Bill Nye the Science Guy. We're going to do a little 5 minutes with Dr. Drew the Science Jew. If you would, give my audience the easy TV digestible version of what is RNA, what is mRNA, and what was the breakthrough that finally allowed for the creation of the COVID vaccine after your decades of research on this?
mRNA is kind of like the middleman. In our cells, the DNA has the codes for every protein, for every biologic function, for everything that allows us to live. The DNA has to communicate with the rest of the cell. And the way it does that is messenger RNA, mRNA, makes a copy of one of those codes in the DNA. And then it transports it to a machine. The machine is called a ribosome. But what it does is it reads the code and makes the protein that the code codes for. So it's the middleman. And what our vaccine did, most vaccines up until this point in time would give the inactivated virus.
Right.
Or sometimes the live virus.
Mm-hmm.
What our vaccine does, it gives the code, the RNA. The cell takes it up, reads that code, and makes lots of the protein. So the COVID vaccine had the spike protein, which is the surface protein that allows it to infect cells. And when you make an antibody against the spike protein, it stops the virus from infecting. And because the RNA is so efficient, and what Katie and I did is we made the RNA better. We made it non-inflammatory so people could tolerate it. And we made it produce 1,000 times more protein. So it's much more efficient. And that combination made the vaccine incredibly potent. The initial results were 95% protection, which you never see with a viral vaccine.
Thank you, Dr. Drew the Science Jew, for this segment. We appreciate it. How did it feel for you to get the vaccine and be like, we've done it, here it is, and now it's in my body and we've reached this threshold?
My dream for my entire life was to make a drug, make a vaccine, make a therapeutic that would save people's lives. And, whether it was one or 10, it didn't matter. But having the RNA put into my arm as a vaccine, that 55 years of dreaming had come to an end.
It's unbelievable. What would you say is the most, or was the most, or is the most frustrating misunderstanding that people have about your work or the vaccine?
I've been working on vaccines for most of my career, and in the past, there were always anti-vaccine people. And we would joke about it and say, well, you know, they're the California hippies who don't believe in anything. And, you know, there was a small number of people and you could figure out how to get around them. And they didn't impact the level of vaccination needed to protect the rest of the country. When it became a political fight, a marker of political allegiance to go against the vaccine, I had never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
And it was so incredibly frustrating because, in my view, our leaders are supposed to help us, are supposed to make us healthy, make us live well, make sure there's food and health care and other things available. And here we had a huge amount of our politicians saying the vaccine is bad, it'll give you cancer, it'll integrate into your DNA, it'll make you magnetic. I mean, Bill Gates is putting chips in, just the massive amount of craziness. And you expect that. There are crazy people who do that. You don't expect our politicians, and such a large number of them, to go against something that everybody knows will help.
Where are you hoping to advance your technology to next? What's the next frontier for what you're working on?
Yeah, so we've got a lot. We have a bunch more vaccines. Influenza and RSV have already been FDA approved. We have vaccines for HIV in clinical trials.
Wow.
For norovirus, for C. diff, for malaria, for dengue. My dream is someday to go anywhere in the world, probably starting with sub-Saharan Africa, with an igloo cooler full of RNA vials and giving people injections of RNA to cure their sickle cell anemia.
How far away do you think you are from that dream of the cooler full of vaccines?
Yeah, I'm going to guess a year and a half, we'll start treating patients.
Amazing. Speaking of what's coming down the pike, we talked about your technology. We also have a new presidential administration. How do you anticipate that this new Trump administration may affect your work, if at all?
So I'm in a lucky position where it probably isn't going to affect me very much. I have lots of sources of funding. I don't rely on the government or the National Institutes of Health. It's going to affect most other researchers. The big fear is, you know, RFK Jr.
Yes.
Has a long history of being an anti-vaccine fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
What people don't realize is that he makes his money suing drug companies for made-up vaccine reactions. So people say, oh, well, you know, that's what he believes. Well, it's not. It's how he makes his money. And now he's going to take that to the NIH, where the majority of vaccine research is done. He tells senators, I'm not going to touch vaccines. I don't believe him. You know, politicians aren't known for their honesty.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that he's going to suddenly give up on his anti-vaccine crusades. The only way he can get major things done, though, is if Congress goes along with him. But there's more and more far-right lunatics in Congress who are part of this anti-vaccine crusade. So it's possible that NIH may reduce its vaccine research, and that's going to hurt a lot of people. Where it's going to be a much bigger problem, right now, all 50 states have laws that say your kids have to be vaccinated against a bunch of different diseases in order to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the Republican-led states are going to get rid of that. We're already having outbreaks of measles from people not getting vaccinated. What people don't realize, if you look back 250 years, 40% of our children didn't become adults. They died before becoming adults. Right now, it's 4%. The major reason for that is vaccines.
Yeah.
Vaccines save more lives than any other medical intervention.
It's so frustrating. It's such a self-inflicted wound. It's such a head-scratcher.
Yeah.
Throughout your life and career, you've had some important partnerships along the way. One, you mentioned just now the National Institutes of Health. You did a fellowship there. Your supervisor was none other than Anthony Fauci. Were you guys in touch during COVID at all as you were working on what you were working on and he was in his role?
We've always spoken, you know, not every week, but fairly often. We would meet at meetings and talk. Once the NIH became interested in RNA vaccines, we spoke more, and I spoke to all of his staff about using RNA vaccines for COVID. So we've kept in touch.
Another crucial partnership that we have touched on lightly, but I want to hear more about, is with your Nobel co-winner, who you call Katie. You worked together at Penn for many years. How did you guys initially meet and begin collaborating?
The stories of the photocopier are true.
Yeah.
When I started at Penn, that was back at a time when the only way you could read a journal article was to photocopy the journal when it was shipped to you. And Katie and I would essentially wait for each other to finish on the photocopier because we both read a lot and you had a photocopy to read. So we started talking, and as it turned out, I was interested in vaccines and I needed somebody who could make mRNA, and Katie knew how to make mRNA. So I look at it as one of those old Reese's moments, the chocolate and peanut butter coming together. And we just started working together and have never stopped.
Amazing. It's like a medical Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
You and Dr. Curico met at Penn. Just as a sort of little side note here, have you been aware while you're at Penn recently over the past year or two of some of the anti-Israel demonstrations going on there? And is that something that's been in your field of view at all?
Yeah, no, it has. I mean, I would pass by the demonstrations on most days when I was walking across campus. Liz McGill, who was the previous president who got into a lot of trouble, was a good friend. And Larry Jamison, the current president, is a good friend. So I would talk to both of them about the anti-Israel sentiment and what was right and what was wrong. What I hopefully got them to understand is that how Israel deals with its external partners is very different from being Jewish and Israel's support of the Jewish religion. And the demonstrators didn't separate those two things. The demonstrators said, oh, we support Hamas because we have to fight back against what we think the Jews are doing to the Palestinians. And that's just a completely crazy approach. And the way it happened is that outside Hamas organizers came into the universities and met with these students and organized these students and built up this thinking. I don't think the students themselves started off with that idea and that approach, but I think the outside organizers changed their way of thinking, and that caused a lot of difficulties.
Have you felt or seen a difference in the temperature on campus from last spring to where we are today?
Larry Jamison, the current president, helped get rid of those destructive fights. They still go on. They're not sleeping on campus. They're not attacking other students. I think the temperature has come down quite a bit. I know other universities are still having some problems.
Oh, yeah. What's the general environment in your medical research field right now towards Jews? Because, you know, I hear anecdotally from a lot of different people within medicine that it can be a very difficult environment. And I'm wondering if you've encountered any of that.
So I've encountered it not amongst my collaborators and other physicians that I work with. There are a lot of anti-vaccine people that they often will send me threatening letters, emails, messages. They threaten my family. They threaten my life. And something that's not uncommon is they'll say that Jewish vaccine. So that they're correlating my, you know, my help in developing the vaccine with Jews and with it being a bad thing, both because it's a vaccine and because a Jew was involved in it. So that there's certainly a lot of hatred of vaccines combined with hatred of Jews that has only increased over the past years.
One more crucial partner in your life is your wife, Mary Ellen, a PhD herself. You met at Brandeis University, which is, of course, a renowned, largely Jewish university. How did the two of you meet?
She was a couple years behind me. She was a psychology student. And one of the things that Brandeis did back then to sort of weed out the number of psychology people was to make them take calculus.
That'll do it.
We had a friend in common who introduced us and said that I would help teach her calculus and get her through the course. So that's how we met. And a couple years after that, we started dating and ended up getting married.
What happened in those interim years between tutoring and dating?
I was in med school, so I was kind of busy with other things. And it just took us a while to get back together.
What role did Judaism play in raising your kids and starting your family?
We're cultural Jews, and we always have been. And both of my daughters went to Hebrew school. They were both bat mitzvahed. They have a lot of Jewish friends that they've maintained. My older daughter has a Friday night dinner at her house. She doesn't have any kids yet, and she's part of an organization that brings a variety of different Jews together in D.C. to do Friday night dinners together, just to share religion, share the culture.
Sure.
And my younger daughter does similar things here. So we brought them up as cultural Jews and let them make the choice of how much religion they wanted to incorporate into their lives.
You yourself, you were raised with a Jewish father and an Italian Catholic mother. Your father is a Jew, is, you know, what we call a patrilineal Jew, embraced by conservative and reform Jewish movements, not so much by the Orthodox movement. Have you ever felt that, like, exclusion, or has that something that's ever come up in your life?
Probably the only time it came up was when I was going to marry Mary Ellen. Her father's family is Orthodox. And back at that time in Memphis, there was one Orthodox synagogue, one conservative, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And the conservative rabbi had just left because he had an affair with somebody's wife, and the conservative synagogue was not in great shape. So we, Mary Ellen and I, went to the Orthodox rabbi in order to see if they would marry us. And he told my father-in-law, of course I'll marry them. And he told us, no way, that I had been converted by a very conservative Jewish rabbi. I had blood drawn. I went to the mikvah. I did everything, but he didn't consider that enough, and he wouldn't marry us.
two follow-ups there. One, you say that you converted. What process did you go through, and when did you do that, and why?
I did that after meeting Mary Ellen. It was actually kind of funny because I was a resident at Beth Israel at the time, and I went to the local conservative synagogue, and Mary Ellen and I walked in, and Mary Ellen is blonde and light-eyed, and we walked in and sat down, and he looks at us, and he says, "Drew Weissman, a doctor from across the street, and Mary Ellen from Memphis, Tennessee." And he turned to her and says, "Why do you want to convert to Judaism?" And she said, "No, no, no, no. I went to day school. I did everything. It's him you have to talk to." So we talked for a little while, and he basically, you know, I had practiced every holiday growing up. I had been to synagogue many times. Yeah. I knew everything about the religion. So I still learned Hebrew. I learned all the prayers. I went through the Orthodox version of conversion with the mikveh and the three rabbis and all of that.
That's a lot of hoops to jump through for somebody who's already Jewish. I mean, how did that feel, having to jump through those?
I knew I was doing them for her family because that's what they required.
Did she require it of you, or do you feel like it was just pressure from her family?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I think she felt the pressure from her family.
What would you say forms the bedrock of your personal Jewish identity?
A lot of it is the recognition of the importance of the Jewish people and of maintaining Judaism for Jewish people to, you know, to fight all of the anti-Semitism in the world as a community, and to build their community to be strong and resilient. We spend a lot of time in Israel because I think it's important to support Israel. We spend a lot of time supporting, you know, even now, but more in the past, Russian Jews and Ethiopian Jews and Jews around the world who have difficult lives, and we would help any way we could.
Are you familiar with the phrase tikkun olam?
Yeah.
Heal the world, repair the world. You're doing that very literally. Has anybody ever told you that before?
Oh, yeah. My wife tells me that all the time.
That's special. That's very cool. I read in an interview that you consider yourself more of a Taoist. Do you still feel that way? And what does that mean to you? And how does that sort of belief system sit alongside or intertwine with your Jewishness?
The Taoist views are more of my view of the world, the earth, and the universe. I used to live out in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and I was close friends with our Aish rabbi, who's now moved back to Israel. And he was a very interesting man. But the rabbi came up to me at the end and said, "So do you have any questions?" And I told him, "I don't want to ask my questions," but he forced me to. So what my question was is, could you read the Talmud as Adam and Eve were actually bacteria? And what the Talmud was actually describing was the beginning of life. How bacteria formed, how bacteria divided, and that's how Eve came from Adam. And what the Talmud was really describing, and we just weren't reading it correctly, was this is how life began. And that was, you know, my Taoist thinking of how everything began and how we need to, you know, revere the earth and everything about it, because it's part of us.
It's so interesting. You know, I've heard sort of a version of that people feel like maybe, you know, when the Torah says God created the world in 7 days, that really that's, you know, 7 eons, let's say, and that's just sort of how the earth was developing. But I've never heard it on like the cellular level from Eve coming from Adam. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I recently watched an interview between Piers Morgan and Neil deGrasse Tyson, And Tyson had this great line in it. He said, God is an ever receding pocket of scientific ignorance for a lot of people. If you believe that God is just sort of there to explain the gaps that we don't understand, do you think it's possible for a scientist to believe in God?
If you think about it, the universe is an enormous space, and the fact that life ever evolved anywhere is an incredibly likely rare thing. I mean, we're the only planet in our solar system to currently have life. If you want to believe that there was a greater being that was involved with that, I don't have a problem with that. And I think there were certainly greater beings that were involved in the creation of the universe. Now, those beings weren't somebody who looked like God and...
Not a bearded guy sitting on a throne.
Right, who said, I decree this. But there were certainly many types of intelligence that were involved. It may not be the type of intelligence people currently ascribe to God, but I think we can certainly believe that there are greater things involved in everything.
I love that. And now the last thing to wrap it up, we do a little lightning round, just some quick pops for you. It's quick answers, nothing too complicated. Is matzo ball soup really Jewish penicillin?
Well, as a doctor, I tell people to eat chicken soup and matzo ball soup when they're sick. But that's mostly because of the nutrients that it has in it.
Good to know. Is there like a Nobel Prize winner group chat? Like, is there a clubhouse? Do you guys interact?
We interact when we run into each other, when we have questions for each other. I just ran into a bunch when I was at the latest Nobel Prize ceremony.
It's a pretty cool club to be in. Must be fun. Are you team applesauce or team sour cream?
Well, we do both at my house. My kids don't like sour cream. My wife and I do.
Do you double dip? Are you getting both on the same latke?
We don't double dip because that's not sanitary.
Right, of course. I forgot who I was talking to. But do you get a scoop of each is what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. The combo. Did you get COVID?
I did. I actually got COVID with all of my family when we went to an award given to us by Harvard Medical School. Mm. And luckily my parents came, but they didn't get COVID. But all of my family did.
If you could have any person alive or dead over to your house for Shabbat dinner, who would it be?
I guess it would probably be Albert Einstein, just because of his incredible creativity and thinking.
I would love to be at that dinner too. And last, we ask this of pretty much all our guests, the Being Jewish special. When you eat challah, do you rip it or do you slice it?
No, I always rip it.
Always. It's like the standard answer.
Yep.
Dr. Weissman, thank you so much for taking time out of your literal life-saving research to sit down with me today. Really, really appreciate it and all of the insights, and wish you all the best on behalf of humanity on everything you're working on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Dr. Weissman for taking time out of his literally world-saving research to talk with me today, and allowing me to cross Nobel laureate who saved humanity from COVID off my guest bucket list. Pretty special stuff. Thanks to you for listening or watching. If you're loving the show, please tell your friends about it, especially the ones who only watch our clips on social media but don't watch the whole episode. Come on, y'all. I'll see y'all back here for the next thrillifying episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Liviashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. and I freaking love you guys.